Security forces have fired on Iranian protesters. Protesters who are angry that their government accidentally shot down a plane, then tried to cover it up.
It's not just about today that the regime is lying. It's about 43 years that they are lying to us. And people are still suspicious about if still are they telling the truth.
Taiwan's voters re-elect a president who opposes China. The mainland reacts.
We've had the state media calling her greedy, evil. We've had the state media questioning the legitimacy of the election.
And the UK is designating plastic-free zones, but that label might be overselling it.
If we had named the program the Slightly Less Plastic Communities Program, it wouldn't have been inspirational for people.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. Grief in Iran has broken into anger. People shouted, "Death to the dictator," a reference to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Protests initially erupted on Saturday after Iran admitted to firing missiles by mistake at the Ukrainian plane that crashed near Tehran and killed 176 people. The admission came a few days after the regime denied any involvement. It's clear that Iranians have complicated feelings toward the regime. For Hamid, he sees these protests as playing a bigger role in his country's future, and he says that the regime can't block the unrest for long. This Iranian protester, whose name we're not using to protect her identity, says it's not the first time the regime has lied to its people.
It's about 43 years that they are lying to us, and people are still suspicious about if still are they telling the truth. They start to beat us, and when we start to have slogans, they start to bombard us on fire. A woman got shot on her leg in front of me. She was, I think, about 40, 42 years old. Everybody who were out, we had deep condolences and deep sorrows for the people of Iran that we have truly lost them in the Ukrainian airplane crash. This is what we cannot tolerate anymore, that they are shooting us, they're killing us, and they're still denying this part.
That view is not universal, though. Some Iranians, like Zainab Khasami-Tari, told me they don't like protesters politicizing the plane crash. Khasami-Tari is a professor at the University of Tehran, and she's sympathetic to Iran's government.
I think it was a very big tragedy for the families and also for many Iranians. I mean, they were ordinary human beings. Their lives matter a lot. I mean, every human being or individual's life is worthy. However, I would disagree with the lady, which actually we heard her clip, that, you know, first of all, when she generalizes this, that the people are all in the streets. So I'm actually teaching at the University of Tehran. It's like I'm not in the main campus. I'm a bit away. However, I didn't see, you know, these are like, there are demonstrations, but it's not as extensive as you have seen a few months ago, like a few weeks ago, which was economically motivated.
What was your own reaction when you heard that the plane had been shot down?
Actually, in the beginning, the timing was very curious. So I, you know, it took them 3 days to announce that they've shot this down by mistake. So it's not a very long time. I think the
mistake was... Well, it was 3 days. It was 3 days of denying it, and there were other intelligence and other countries were saying
say, okay,
that it was pretty clear that it had come from Iran. So
so
3 days is a long time.
Tell the public that we are actually having or conducting investigations, and we cannot actually... This total denial of what happened, you know, was actually what many people find, you know, something to be angry at.
And what are your feelings about that total denial for 3 days?
I think, like many other people, I think it was a very bad mistake. And I feel that this is like something that you have to respond to. That why actually it took them 3 days, and not 3 days, but why actually they denied this totally from the beginning.
Well, what's your opinion of the protests that began Saturday in response to the Iranian government's admission that the plane was shot down?
You know, it's a bit difficult. Like, you know, it is a humanitarian issue in a sense. It actually deals with people's feelings and sentiments. And then making it like a politicized, you know, movement makes it like a bit complicated to make comments on. I understand that people are angry. However, what I would actually do at this time is, like, instead of going to streets, asking the government legally to respond, you know, or to take action against those who actually conducted mismanagement of this crisis, instead of going to streets, tearing down, you know.
Well, I think in that clip we heard at the top of this interview, that person said that a woman had been shot in the leg at a protest.
Mm-hmm. So what I would actually say is that I think there should be a space and time given to these people to express their grief and their sentiments. However, it should not take a sort of violent direction.
Zainab Qasami-Tari is a professor at the University of Tehran. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Need a refresher on why the U.S.-Iran relationship has been so bad for so long? We have a news timeline for you. It's at theworld.org. In Taiwan, people expressed their frustration at the ballot box this weekend. They handed a landslide victory to Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the election a model for the region and a force for good in the world. But the result is not going over well in China, as the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Crushing victory for President Tsai is also a setback for China's government. The People's Republic sees Taiwan as an inseparable part of China. But Tsai won re-election with a promise for more autonomy from the mainland. She got more than 8 million votes, the largest tally ever in the history of Taiwan. In her victory speech, she repeated her promise to safeguard Taiwan's freedom and democracy. About a year ago, Tsai's victory was all but unthinkable. She was deeply unpopular in the polls, and her chief rival was expected to win election with his promise to move Taiwan closer to China. But then, this happened. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy protests began in June and never really stopped. The Chinese government, which controls Hong Kong, has been uncompromising. The police response has been harsh. And Taiwanese voters, like Xiao Hanwei in Taipei, are worried that Taiwan could one day lose its autonomy and become more like Hong Kong. I support the Hong Kong protesters, Xiao says. I have to vote so our future doesn't end up like theirs. The BBC's Celia Hatton was a longtime China editor. She says Beijing tried to influence Taiwan's election campaign, but misplayed its hand.
A year ago, China's president Xi Jinping gave a speech where he warned that Taiwan simply had to accept that it would be reunified with mainland China. And he refused to rule out the idea that China might eventually use force.
China has backed up those threats with a massive military buildup, and most recently by sending an aircraft carrier through the Taiwan Strait. Voters on the island of Taiwan responded to the pressure from Beijing by sending a message on Election Day. The Chinese government is not happy about President Tsai's win. Here's Celia Hatton again.
We've had the state media calling her greedy, evil. We've had the state media questioning the legitimacy of the election.
And China's top diplomat warned Taiwan that, quote, those who split the country will be doomed to leave a stink for 10,000 years. It's a reminder that in the eyes of Beijing, Taiwan will always be a part of China. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Now, an American news story with a global reach. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says his state will no longer accept new refugees. He notified Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a letter on Friday. Abbott is the first governor to take advantage of an executive order signed by President Trump in September. The order allows states to opt out of the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. Cindy Huang is from Refugees International, an NGO that works on resettlement worldwide. She says this is the latest example of the U.S. stepping back from its role as a global leader on refugee issues.
Since 1980, the U.S. has taken in 3 million of the more than 4 million refugees who have been resettled worldwide. So the U.S. historically has played a leading role and unfortunately has taken a turn away from that.
What countries around the world are leading on refugee resettlement and what are the numbers?
In 2018, Canada, for the first time, resettled more refugees than the United States did. The United States continues to be the leading provider of humanitarian assistance. But on the diplomatic front, you may recall that in 2016, there was a process to create a global compact on refugees. And that was really to have an honest conversation about the scale of the crisis and see how we could coordinate better with other countries. And in the end, only the U.S. and Hungary did not sign on. That's another piece of evidence that it's not only around resettling refugees, which is a very small percentage of refugees worldwide ever even have the chance to be resettled, but the U.S. is also stepping back from engaging in the broad range of diplomatic and other aspects of addressing refugee crises.
So with Texas becoming the first state to opt out of the refugee resettlement program, does that mean that no refugees will be settled in Texas?
The intent of Governor Abbott sending that letter would mean that at least for the next year, no refugees would be directly resettled there. However, it's important to note that three resettlement agencies are currently in the process of claiming that this executive order is unlawful. And last week, there was a hearing for a preliminary injunction to suspend the implementation of the executive order that gives governors and county executives the right to, quote unquote, veto the acceptance of refugees in their state.
Now, what happens to the refugees who would have been resettled in Texas and are now not going to be? Will they be absorbed by other states in the U.S.?
It's possible, and in fact, Governor Abbott noted that once a refugee comes to the U.S., they're free to move to other states. However, when a refugee is resettled in a particular community, there's a lot of support that's designed around that, you know, to help them find a job, learn English, have people play with their kids. And if a refugee goes to another state and then moves to Texas, they won't have that same level of service.
The global refugee crisis is something we've been talking about for years. Looking at it right now, has it crested or are the numbers likely to get bigger?
They're likely to get bigger for a number of reasons. And, you know, we need to look no further than in Latin America, in a country like Venezuela, where we don't see a solution to the root causes of the crisis. And so I think that's where, when I was speaking about U.S. retrenchment in leadership, and of course, the U.S. leadership has never been perfect, but without that role in trying to find more sustainable solutions to resolving conflict, it's not a positive trajectory that we're likely getting on.
Cindy Huang is the Vice President for Strategic Outreach at Refugees International. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
At long last, Diego can relax. The 100-year-old giant tortoise will be returning to the wild on the Galapagos island of Española after helping bring a species back from the brink of extinction. Diego is one of a few males responsible for siring an entire new flourishing generation of tortoises. President of Galapagos Conservancy, Johanna Barry, says Diego was a significant piece of a larger giant tortoise restoration project.
It's our ambition to re-tortoise islands where tortoises have either become vulnerable or have gone extinct. And that's a very ambitious goal.
Diego was likely taken in the 1930s, then lived for decades at the San Diego Zoo. He became the program's coolest dude.
When it comes to tortoise personalities, Diego was relatively outgoing. He did have a rather curious personality, a forceful personality. He would come up and look at people and sometimes even hiss at people.
In the 1960s, there were 14 of Diego's kind left on the island. Now there are almost 2,000. Nearly half can call Diego dad or grandpa. Barry says scientists are thrilled with the results.
This is an enormous conservation success. And conservation is often a game that breaks your heart. So when we have a good news story like this, it's worth celebrating.
Barry was upset about one thing, however. Another tortoise named E5 fathered even more babies. But come on, who wants to tell a story about E5 when you have Diego? Want to look at this handsome guy? He's on our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Canary Wharf is one of London's banking and commercial zones. It's also now the world's first plastic-free commercial center. We asked reporter Brenna Daldorf to check it out, and what she discovered there was pretty different from what she expected.
Martin Gettings is the head of sustainability at Canary Wharf Group. He's giving me a tour of all of the eco-friendly measures in this multi-billion dollar commercial district. If you weren't looking, you could totally miss them. In the mall, there's a machine where you can return bottles and cans for a voucher, which Getting says is the first of its kind in the UK. And there are 7 stations where you can refill your water bottle. For the past few years, Getting's has been crafting initiatives to cut down on plastic waste across Canary Wharf.
It all culminated in World Environment Day this year, where we were announced as the world's first plastic-free commercial centre and the first district in London to achieve this status.
Which is why I'm here. Getting says this accreditation comes from the group Surfers Against Sewage, or SAS. And to get it, they had to hit a number of targets showing their commitment to reducing plastic.
You know, achieving a status and having a certificate on the wall doesn't really mean anything. What's important is that the behaviours and the culture that we've created carries on.
One target was for Canary Wharf to get 34 businesses to agree to cut out 3 items of single-use plastic. Ultimately, they got 50 to sign up.
Of course, it really is just a drop in the ocean compared to what's being generated every day across the world. But what it does do, and this is really important, it highlights the issue and it shows other people that this actually can be done. And if all communities and all cities did this, then we'd be well down the way to resolving this problem.
I can see how committed Getting's is to reducing waste. But when I walked through the mall with him, I saw tons of single-use plastic in this zone labeled plastic-free. Sandwiches and plastic packaging, plastic-wrapped fruit and vegetables, plastic bags. It kind of made me wonder, is all this just greenwashing? Everyone I stop in the mall seems to care about reducing waste. Rapper and music producer Adrian Coker says he pops into the Waitrose supermarket here almost every day.
Yeah, I live around the corner.
Oh, perfect. So did you know that they have an initiative going on to use less plastic?
Nope, had no clue, but that's good.
But when I tell him about the plastic-free status, he's a little wary.
Interesting. What does that look like, though? I come into Waitrose every day, and the bags, they're still plastic, and you can take a bag every single time if you want to.
It turns out Surfers Against Sewage, SAS, the group that designated Canary Wharf its first plastic-free commercial zone, it's also given that accreditation to hundreds of communities across the United Kingdom. SAS is based in Cornwall. So that's how I find myself fighting the November wind on Mar Zion Beach in the rugged southwest corner of England, in a little spot where a river meets the sea. I'm with Rachel Yates. She started out volunteering with Surfers Against Sewage on beach cleanups.
We could spend the whole day picking up and clearing a patch, but you'd come back tomorrow and it would be just as bad. And that really upsets me. This is a prime example of how we cannot beach clean our way out of this problem.
That's why she was excited when SAS launched their Plastic-Free Communities program and its toolkit for accreditation. She says it provides a structure for tackling the problem at its source.
If you've got a flood, you don't manically mop, you turn the tap off. And here was this community toolkit that showed you how to turn that tap off.
The toolkit includes steps like getting local businesses to cut out at least 3 items of single-use plastic, working with schools and community groups, holding events, and setting up a steering group. Yates helped the nearby town of Penzance get plastic-free status in 2018, the first community in the UK or anywhere else to do so. And it got a lot of press.
We had news teams from Japan, from Germany, from Canada, from Denmark, from just all over.
And when Yates and I head to downtown Penzance, everyone we speak to seems to know about the accreditation. For the most part, they're really positive about it. Then we come across Sean Harris.
Well, it's not really plastic free though, is it? There's plastic everywhere.
So Rachel here works actually for Plastic Free Penzance.
Sure.
So what would you say about the name Plastic Free?
So yeah, I mean, the name is the campaign name. It doesn't mean that Penzance is plastic free. So it means you're on the journey, and to get the status, it's hitting certain kind of milestones to show that you've laid the foundations for that journey. Because the reality is, the manager at McDonald's, she can't make a decision not to have those, you know, plastic knives and forks and things, but our local business owners and managers can. Yeah. And then that pressure will hopefully put the pressure on the chains in the town to do, yeah, to do the same thing. Yeah,
it's a good idea.
The next day, I go to the headquarters of Surfers Against Sewage in St. Agnes, a small community known as a surf hub.
Yeah, I'm Hugo Tagheim. I'm the chief executive of Surfers Against Sewage.
When it started back in 1990, SAS was just a group of surfers and beach lovers who would go out and clean their favorite beaches. SAS still runs beach cleans all across the UK. But now they also focus on tackling plastic waste at the source, which includes lobbying government and businesses for change. They led a campaign for a ban on plastic straws, stirrers, and ear swabs, which the UK government passed in May 2019.
We can equally as wear a wetsuit here in St. Agnes in Cornwall or put on a suit and tie and talk to people in Canary Wharf.
SAS launched Plastic Free Communities in 2017, based on the model for accrediting fair trade communities. Tagholm says a lot of people had wanted to address the plastic issue, but didn't know how. So SAS developed a five-step plan.
It's probably the most critical part of this program, and that's why it's been so successful. People have loved it. It's enabled them to organize.
In the past 2 years, 647 communities have been accredited as plastic-free. Which sounds good, but again, what about the name?
If we had named the program the Slightly Less Plastic Communities Program, it wouldn't have been inspirational for people. I think there's a very clear vision with the name we chose that people want to work towards, and it's a long-term commitment.
Ultimately, says Tagholm, the accreditation is just meant to be a starting point. I still struggle with that. I called lots of experts on waste reduction and environmental communications to get their opinion. Some said they found the plastic-free designation problematic and a bit misleading, though the program itself is doing good work. But one expert told me I shouldn't quibble with the name, because the real problem is big oil companies that continue to spew out cheap plastic that we don't need. Before leaving Penzance, I stopped by Thorne's. It's a small independent grocery store that has become a plastic-free champion under the initiative. There's a lot of single-use plastic in here. But then I start talking to Sue Hendy, who owns this place with her husband. She shows me their newest addition, a refill milk machine and glass bottles.
Yeah, so it's just literally plugged in.
Yeah.
And this is like a little fridge in the top.
Hendy says they're making changes where they can.
We just thought that there were different things that we could do, so we didn't have to buy pre-packed apples. We didn't have to put potatoes into plastic bags, and so just gradually some things worked, some things didn't work.
She says it's all about trial and error.
There will always be people that say, oh, well, you know, the milk is still in a bag in the side of the box, but we're trying, you know. It's better than sitting back going, oh, there's nothing we can do, so let's just leave the milk in the plastic bottles. We're trying to do something.
And she says it makes a difference. For the world, Brenna Daldorf, Penzance.
Across the globe, there's a severe shortage of nurses, and the further you are from hospitals, the more acute the crisis.
In remote areas, the only person they will see is a nurse. So they're everything to that patient.
I'm Carol Hills. The World Health Organization says it's time to give nurses the respect they're due. That's coming up on The World. The United States and Iran seem to have stepped back from the brink of war, but they haven't resolved their differences, and both sides are engaged in a conflict through proxies. In Lebanon, the leader of the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, says this is just the beginning. Rebecca Collard reports from Beirut.
The face of Qasem Soleimani is everywhere in this mostly Shiite neighborhood in Beirut. Every few steps, there's another poster of the late Iranian military commander. In some of them, he's being embraced by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In others, he's alone, looking pensive and ready for anything. Also on display are posters of fighters from Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, killed in action. They are seen as martyrs, along with their former Iranian patron, Qasem Soleimani. Before her father's funeral in Tehran, Zainab Soleimani gave an interview to the pro-Hezbollah TV station El Manar. Behind her were photos of her father and Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah. I send my regards to the Sayyid of the resistance, our uncle, Hassan Nasrallah, the general's daughter said. I know he will avenge the blood of my father. Her faith in Nasrallah is well-founded. Iran has long supported and relied on allies and proxies across the Middle East. In Iraq, it trained in armed militias to fight against ISIS and attack the American military. In Syria, Iranian-backed militias fought against rebel groups trying to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. And here in Lebanon, Hezbollah is the most powerful military force in the country, better armed even than Lebanon's National Army. Thousands of people flooded to Beirut's southern suburbs to mourn the death of Soleimani last week. They held photos of the Iranian general and the yellow flag of Hezbollah. Nasrallah addressed the crowd via video link from a secret location. He hasn't appeared in public for years, fearing just the sort of fate that came to Soleimani. The Hezbollah leader vowed that this so-called axis of resistance would avenge Soleimani's death. And by that, he means all of Iran's allies and proxies. Nasrallah went on to say that American civilians should not be touched, and he warned of a new phase for the region. But experts say whatever that new phase looks like, Hezbollah will want to keep it outside of Lebanon. Hassan Issa works in a bakery here, and like many of his Shiite Muslim neighbors, he says he's a proud supporter of Hezbollah. Qasem Soleimani is gone, says Issa, but there are thousands more like him and stronger, too. But both Issa and his co-worker, Ahmed al-Ahmed, say Hezbollah is not interested in starting a war. All options are possible, but Hezbollah wouldn't think of bringing war to this country, Ahmed says. But if war is imposed on us, of course we will have to respond. A few streets over, Nour el-Din is watching television in his grocery shop. He says he's not worried about war breaking out either. Nasrallah said he won't strike American civilians, only soldiers, says el-Din. We don't have any U.S. soldiers here. There are a small number of American soldiers here, but attacking them would be tricky for Hezbollah. Those troops are in Lebanon to train the Lebanese army, and Hezbollah is unlikely to risk killing any Lebanese soldiers in a country where many people revere the army. Experts say Hezbollah is proceeding with caution. And another sign is the fact that there have been no big anti-American protests by Hezbollah supporters here. But there is one thing that the crowds in Tehran and Baghdad have been chanting that seems to go over well here. And that's the call for U.S. troops to leave the Middle East. And that would be the biggest victory of all, says shopkeeper Nour el-Din. All the Americans getting out, just like they left Vietnam. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Before we leave Lebanon, a note on Carlos Ghosn. The former head of Nissan surfaced in Lebanon this month after fleeing allegations of financial crimes in Japan. Ghosn is rumored to have escaped Japan in a Yamaha musical instrument case, a stunt that people are now mimicking on social media. Yamaha has waded in with the request, essentially, do not try this at home. This weekend, Yamaha Music Japan tweeted, "There have been a lot of tweets about people getting into large musical instrument cases." The thread continues, "The case is designed to accommodate musical instruments and audio equipment. Please use it correctly." Let's take a moment to say thanks to nurses. Nurses have always been critical to healthcare, but their role has often been underappreciated. The World Health Organization is making an effort to correct that. It's named 2020 the Year of the Nurse and Midwife. Annette Kennedy knows both of those roles well. She led the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organization for nearly two decades. Annette, I want to start 200 years ago with Florence Nightingale. She founded the first nursing school in 1860 in London. Here's an early recording.
I hope my voice may perpetuate.
She says, I hope my voice may perpetuate the great work of my life. Nightingale is known for making the case that more soldiers died from infections than from injuries. What does Nightingale represent to you?
I suppose Nightingale was the first to look for professionalism for nurses and for education for nurses and to have them recognized. When I even look at her writings, I'm very taken by the fact that she was recognized for certain things, but she wasn't recognized for actually managing a service better than anybody at that time.
Now, fast forward to today, how has nursing changed?
It's changed dramatically. I see nurses all over the world. In some areas, the only profession that a patient will see or a family or community will see in their lifetime, and they will receive everything from that nurse. In remote areas, whether you're talking about Australia, New Zealand, the only person they will see is a nurse. So they're everything to that patient.
How did you get into nursing yourself?
There was very little choice when I was growing up in the west of Ireland. The choices were that you could either join the religious life, you could be a teacher, you could be a secretary, or you could be a nurse. And so I was lucky in the fact that I absolutely enjoyed nursing. I enjoyed looking after patients. I enjoyed the interaction with people. And I enjoyed the fact that you felt that you were doing some good for somebody.
You know, nursing used to be one of the only professions you could go into as a woman in many countries. And so that presents it with a kind of reputation challenge for a career to choose now for women. Isn't that part of the issue?
I honestly don't think that's the case now. What makes them leave the profession is dissatisfaction. Not having enough resources, not getting support, not being well treated, and not getting sufficient salary.
Around the world, there's a major shortage in nurses in the coming year. What's the magnitude of that shortage?
I don't think we can calculate it. It's estimated at 9 million because we're 50% of the workforce. We deliver 90% of the hands-on care. But I would easily double that because even if you look at China, China has 4.5 million nurses to, what is it, 1.2 billion people. They could double and triple that to have enough.
How do the shortages get resolved in places like your country, Ireland, and other parts of Europe?
The easiest thing is to grow your own and retain your own. And that's what we'd be asking in 2020 for governments to invest in their own nurses. It's not to say that it isn't good to have experience from other countries, but if you're taken from countries that are short, the Philippines are now, they have been the one that's exporting the most nurses all over the world. And yet they themselves are short. But it suits governments to send them so that they'll send money back.
You know, I'm not trying to be provocative, but I need to ask
it. Of course, go ahead.
When you look at this kind of WHO declaration, you know, it's the year of the nurse, it's hard for me not to think that it's kind of patronizing. Like, you know, if it was a valued role, why would it need to be recognized in this way?
Yeah, and perhaps you're right. But what other way do you have to increase the profile of nurses? Because I don't believe that people understand what nurses do. I don't believe that they understand that they're the backbone of the service. And if you withdraw them from the service, you have no health service. So for me, it's a year to make people aware, to get them into leadership positions, to get them into policy. Like if we're there with people in the community, in the families, from birth to death, and they should be able to share the information that they have because they're so close to everything.
Which is just what Florence Nightingale did.
Yeah, but she found it very difficult too.
Annette Kennedy is president of the International Council of Nurses. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're more than welcome, Cara.
Today, the fight against ISIS and other militant groups has gone well beyond places like Iraq and Syria. In the Sahel region, south of the Sahara Desert in Africa, countries like Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso are also on the front lines. And the violence has been getting worse. France is now hosting a summit with the Sahel G5 to discuss a way forward. The World's Halima Gakandi joins me in the studio. Halima, what's this summit all about?
The summit is taking place in the city of Pau in southwestern France. French President Emmanuel Macron had requested to meet with African leaders of G5 countries, which is a group of countries in the Sahel that have joined together to fight terrorism and other challenges in the region.
Why was the summit called at all? Was there something that prompted it?
Yes, well, the summit was called shortly after 13 French troops died during an operation against terrorist militias in Mali back in November. And many of the soldiers who were killed were actually based in Pau, where the summit is being held today. And France President Macron is looking to get explicit support for French military engagement in the region. Macron has criticized the fact that West African leaders are not doing enough to quell what he said was anti-French rhetoric in the country. So he's looking to get a clear statement of support that these African countries want French and international forces in the region to address mounting security issues.
And there's been a real growth of violence in the region. Why is that?
There really has. I mean, this region in the Sahel has experienced a lot of violence in recent years, from ethnic clashes to armed militias. But it's really the prevalence of these armed militias and terror groups that have been catching the headlines recently, because they've been waging these deadly attacks on both military and civilian targets. It's especially bad in this area that borders Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, where a lot of people have died in attacks.
And do we know anything about who these militias are that are wreaking so much havoc?
Well, some of these groups are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, some are affiliated with ISIS, but it's really hard to know at which time which group is doing what. And it's also interspersed with this ethnic and intercommunal violence that has existed in the region already.
And of course, when a country like France talks about wanting to engage in West Africa and the Sahel region, I think it rings a lot of bells in that region, because a lot of these countries are former colonies. So how's that going down?
It has. I mean, today France has more than 4,000 troops spread across the Sahel region. I spoke with Hassan Hamadou, who is the Mali country director of the Norwegian Refugee Council, which is a humanitarian organization. And Hamadou himself is from Niger.
And at the same time, we have an increase in the insecurity, despite a heavy investment in military intervention and forces.
On Friday, his organization and others called for civilians to be the priority of today's discussions. His organization noted that the military operations in the region have actually contributed to the displacement of thousands of people. And some people from these countries have been protesting against French military presence altogether. And it's really reflecting the growing frustration against the security situation, which continues to deteriorate despite this presence of French and UN forces.
I mean, should France be there at all at this point?
It's a really complicated question. Some people have argued that the French military has not been effective in its mission there, especially considering the fact that violence is only growing. And others have argued that the French presence has even helped contribute to the problem. Andrew Leibovich is a visiting fellow at the European Council of Foreign Relations. He studies the Sahel.
This is one case where counterterrorism operations that have sometimes privileged local allies who are also party to this conflict.
Leibovich says the international community should be focusing more on addressing local issues, especially when it comes to the rule of law and the economy.
So where does the U.S. fit in all this? I mean, does it even have a role?
The U.S. does have a role, but we're still waiting to see what the future of U.S. troop deployment will be in the region. Last year, the U.S. Air Force opened up a new base in Niger, which, of course, is in the Sahel region. But we've been hearing reports that U.S. troops may be withdrawing in Africa, so we're still waiting to see.
The World's Halima Gikandi, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And a quick update. French President Emmanuel Macron just announced he will be sending 220 more French troops to the Sahel region. When somebody calls for a family meeting, it rarely means good news. And the royals, they're just like us. The British royal family met at the Queen's Sandringham estate today. They needed to hash out details of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's plan to take a step back from their royal duties. After today's meeting, the Queen released a statement saying she respects Harry and Meghan's decision to lead a more independent life. Royal biographer Robert Lacey says the message was both empathetic and personal.
It's remarkably hands-on. I mean, it may have been processed through officials, but this is the Queen. And I think coming right through it is the concern she feels.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have decided to split their time between the UK and Canada. It's been 10 years since a magnitude 7 earthquake rocked Haiti. More than 300,000 people were killed, according to Haiti's official count. Hundreds of thousands more lost their homes. Services and memorials took place across the country this weekend to mark the anniversary. A decade on, many of the crumbled buildings from the quake have yet to be rebuilt, and thousands of Haitians remain homeless. When Haitian President Jovenel Moïse visited the country's largest mass grave over the weekend, protesters interrupted with music. Haitian filmmaker and journalist Etan Dupont was there.
The president and the whole ambassadors, they had to rush the ceremony because they did not want to deal with the protesters.
What were the protesters chanting?
Down President Jovenel Moïse. They said a lot of bad things against the representative of the international community who were there.
As Haiti notes this very emotional anniversary over the weekend, what was the message from the president? What was he trying to convey?
He called for unity, he called for sacrifice, and he called for dialogue.
Now, it sounds like these protesters have been protesting this president for a while, and they use this 10th anniversary of the earthquake to continue protests. But what is it that they don't like?
President Jovenel Moïse, first of all, came to power with like 18% of the eligible voters in this country that participate. And then this was followed by two reports from the Court of Auditors who accused the president directly and his companies of corruption. And this report sparked a huge anti-corruption movement in Haiti that turned, you know, thousands of people on the street doing months-long of protests.
I know you went to several memorials over the weekend. What were they like?
It was a very moving weekend and a very painful one. Yesterday, I went to one of the area that called Fort National, where a lot of people die, which it was one of the most affected area. People gathered, they gave coffee to the dead, they paid their respect, they put out flowers.
When you spoke to people, what did they say to you?
It's very, very sensitive. People like mostly remember the people that they lost in January 2010. But also there's a lot of frustration because 10 years later, people feel like nothing has really changed. The number of people with food insecurity that need food aid might jump to 4.6 million people coming March, according to the World Food Program, which is a very, very big problem. And I had a very, very interesting conversation, and I went to a book signing of Haiti's top geologist who works in the seismic area in Haiti. He was very concerned. If there is another earthquake, we might have the same type of tragedy again.
Now, President Jovenel Moïse, he's 3 years into his five-year term, but as of today, he's ruling by decree. What is the current government situation in Haiti?
Today, the parliament term is over. Two-thirds of the Senate is gone. That means the Senate is dysfunctional. And all the lower chamber also gone. So the president will be ruling by decree started from today, which is a new phase of the political crisis because the president had control of both chambers. He couldn't pass a government. For me, there's a lot of unknown. We need to wait and see what's going to happen.
Do you anticipate more protests and more instability in the weeks and months ahead?
There will be more protests for sure because the president, by decree, he can replace every local official because it's not only the parliament that is dysfunctional. All the mayors, all the local authorities, he will be able to replace all of them by decree. And then a lot of people fear that he put back the army because we don't have a really, really good history and a lot of bad memories there. And I think some people have legitimate concern because there are hundreds of victims from the old army. And then to see the president bring back the army, it's very concerning.
Etan Dupont is a Haitian filmmaker. I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Times right now, but Haitian and Haitian American performance artists are thriving.
My name is Natalie Joachin. The name of my album is Femme d'Haïti, and that means Women of Haiti.
Some of her songs are traditional Haitian tunes, some more recent ones written by Haitian women long overshadowed by their male peers. Here's Natalie Joachin to tell us more about her new album.
I was inspired to make this album after the passing of my maternal grandmother because her voice was one that was quite important to me throughout the course of her life. And I was really contemplating the idea of women's voices in Haiti and what it means to my own heritage, but what it also means to the country's history.
Papa loco, où se va? Pour s'en aller, nous ces papillons apportent nouvelle bagage.
And so I started finding out about some very wonderful female artists from Haiti and found not only some very beautiful music, but also some really wonderful stories.
Papa loco, où se vont? Pour s'en aller, nous ces papillons apportent.
I would say that one of my favorite stories of my grandmother actually is very deeply connected to this album and is featured here. The song that her voice is featured on is called Madame Bellegarde, which was in fact her maiden name.
Madame Bellegarde condamnée, oui, condamnée.
She was really criticized in her life because she became a widow when my mother was still an infant, quite young. And she never remarried, and she really chose to live a life independently. And so she wrote this song and would sing it. I think, you know, people in our farming community know her for this song because she used to sing it proudly, because she understood that she was judged for the life that she chose to live. But she also felt that she made the right decisions for herself and her family. I hope that every young woman who listens to this album takes away the strength and the power in continuing to lift each other up. To find your tribe, to find other women, to look to your elders and find strength in their stories, and to be sure to leave a pathway for those coming up behind you.
Nathalie Joache has found her own path on her Grammy-nominated album, Femme d'Haïti. And that's where we have to leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.